Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, Ad Nauseam listeners, to episode 19 of the podcast. My name is David Noe. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Winkle. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Dave?
Doing real well and glad to be back at it in this, the new year.
Back at it. Where were you?
Well, my family and I took some time off to the great state of Florida, picked up some sunshine. I'm tanned. I'm rested. I'm ready to go.
Fabulous. All three of those things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm probably one of those things
okay.
right now.
Okay. Which one is that?
I'm not sure. I'll let you know later.
We'll find out in the course of the episode.
Yeah.
So we're going to give a shout out to our friend Jay Curry from Topeka, Kansas.
Jay, how you doing, Jay?
Jay, we're so glad that you have been a loyal listener. And I know Jay from his Greek studies with me.
He does the Moss method.
That's right. You almost forgot the name there, Winkle.
It's been a while. Yeah.
So Jay's been studying Greek very diligently. We'll hear a little more from him later on in the episode. Listeners, stay tuned.
Excellent.
So Jeff, what do we have today?
We are talking Thermopylae.
Thermopylae.
The famous battle, the 300 Spartans. One of the more famous military episodes from ancient Greek history.
Absolutely.
And one that has been thoroughly mythologized at the same time. And so we're gonna get under the skin.
All right. Yes. Changed the course of history, right?
Yes.
It was a seminal battle, August, September 480 BC.
Yes.
And we have an opening quote, don't we?
We do. I'm going to read it.
You're going to read this one?
It's so beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
Yeah. So Dave picked the quote this week. But
Jeff gets to read it.
I get to read
some
it.
Some kind of cosmic injustice.
I told Dave maybe 30 minutes ago that this was my favorite opening quote.
This guy can write.
This is from Peter Green. And his book, The Greco-Persian Wars, University of California Press, came out in 1996. He's talking about before the last stand of the Spartans and the other Greeks that were with them in the Pass of Thermopylae. Green writes, "So Leonidas and his men stood to arms for the last time, silent because there was nothing left to say, waiting patiently as the August sun climbed the sky and their shadows shortened, and the air filled with that odd blended scent of thyme and sulfur and the brackish tang of the sea marshes. Many of them were wounded. Hardly a shield or helmet, but bore witness to the fateful battering they had taken during the past 48 hours. And then, about 9 o'clock, Xerxes' battalions began to advance towards the neck of the pass."
Hmm. Stirring.
It is. That hair on the back of the neck kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, Peter Green can write. So what we're going to offer listeners today is not just your typical look at the Battle of Thermopylae in a two-parter. We are going to give them some background on Greek history, the character and nature of Spartan government, and that interesting militaristic state. But more than that, we're going to give them a very close look at the battle itself in two parts.
That's right.
So today, we're going to cover some of those elements I just mentioned. We're going to prepare the ground, so to speak. And then in the follow-up episode a week from now, we're going to take them right to the final moments of the battle itself and include as a tag on at the end our own travelogue, our trip. Jeff and I have visited that site how many times now?
Gosh, I've been to Thermopylae maybe, I think, 5 or 6 times now.
Yeah, for me, I think it's 3 or 4.
So each time I've taken students to Greece, we've made a stop there.
Yes.
And it never fails to enthrall.
Yes, inspiring and amazing.
It is.
Really quite incredible. And we're going to do all of this through the prism of this amazing book by our friend Peter Green. Actually, I knew Peter Green when I was the student of his late wife, Karen Green, at the University of Iowa.
Is he still an active scholar?
He is nonagenarian. Yeah, he's in his 90s and just a fantastic writer. And he's done it all. He's seen it all. Someday, perhaps, we'll do a little series on famous classicists we have known.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could be more interesting to a general audience?
That's right. Well, this book is fantastic. And his work on Alexander, it's anything he's written is worth looking at.
Alexander to Actium, his biography.
His biography, great stuff.
Just writes in a lyrical fashion.
I was doing some looking around on YouTube and, you know, on Thermopylae. There's a ton of stuff out there.
There is.
And if I can say so, a lot of it is just garbage.
Why do you say so, Jeff, other than pure podcasting self-interest?
Well, the way some of these presenters pronounce the Greek is fingernails on a chalkboard.
Okay.
But it's all very skeletal. It's very, I read the Wikipedia page kind of stuff. And so my hope and your hope is that we can kind of counter a lot of that stuff and really do a detailed look at this battle from a number of different angles.
Absolutely. All right. So let's get right into it.
Okay.
So the conflict that led to this battle, which I already mentioned, was in August and September of 480. The conflict has quite a background. Almost 20 years now, the Persians and the Greeks have been at odds before we get to Thermopylae.
Right. So the hope here is that in the future we'll do a much more detailed episode on this conflict. And so we just want to give you, the listener, just kind of the structure of this. So some foundational ground which will better explain the battle at Thermopylae.
So we can really trace the conflict back to the rise of a man named Cyrus.
Cyrus.
Cyrus the Persian. He comes to power, or he's born actually, around 590 BC. And for most of that century, most of the 6th century, he's hard at work consolidating Persian power.
Yeah, we'll have some maps up on the show notes. But if you look at the expanse of the Persian Empire, it's incredible.
It's massive.
It's massive. Mm-hmm. I mean, people talk about the expanse of Alexander's empire. And I guess in terms of like sheer territory and square mileage, maybe it's bigger. But in terms of land that was held on to and consolidated, right, nobody's got it over the Persians.
No. And of course, Alexander, obviously for a different episode, is really just conquering Persian territory.
Right.
So they're almost coextensive, the Persian Empire and that of Alexander. So Cyrus comes to power. He's a man who's mentioned in the Old Testament.
This is Cyrus the Great.
Yes, in several places. He's mentioned in Isaiah, in Nehemiah. Darius, then, one of his successors in 521, Darius really got this conflict started with the Greeks. And it happened through a Lydian. Now, it's going to get a little complicated here, but we're going to go through it quite quickly. So in Western Asia Minor, Jeff, we got the Lydian kingdom, right?
Yes. So it really is geography. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As the Persians start to push into Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey today, you have these kingdoms on the Asia Minor coast, on the Turkish coast there, which are Hellenic, a lot of them. You have the Lydian kingdom there, and you start to get this friction between the expanding Persian Empire, which is expanding out from Babylon into these territories.
So the Lydian kingdom is ruled by a man named Croesus, whose name becomes legendary for wealth. And as the Persians move west, like you were saying, they encounter the Lydian kingdom of Croesus. Croesus and the Persians, they're kind of on the outskirts of Greek influence.
Yes.
So all along that western coast, a region called Ionia, you have these little Greek kingdoms, Mytilene, Halicarnassus, Miletus, all these places.
Right, places where they are still littered with Greek ruins.
That's right.
Up and down that coast.
Famous city of Ephesus is right there. We go north to Troy. And so this becomes the flashpoint between the westward expansion of the Persian Empire and the tiny little Greek city-states that are ringed around the Aegean.
Right, so this kind of David and Goliath story is already being set up here. Right.
Yes.
I might mention that one of the more famous stories, almost certainly apocryphal stories about Croesus, is this famous story about how he starts to get nervous about the Persians encroaching on his territory. So he sends a delegate to the oracle at Delphi and asks the oracle, asks Apollo,
yes,
what he should do about the Persians. And the oracle famously replies something along the lines of, if you attack the Persians, you will destroy a great empire. And
Herodotus records that for us.
Yeah, exactly, right. And so Croesus takes that as, oh, green light, it's good to go. But of course, the switcheroo is that the great empire he destroys is his own.
So in the 6th century, the Greek city-states are mostly organized as tyrannies. Not tyranny in the sense of violent absolute ruler that we consider it now, but more in the sense of king under a different name.
Right, the Greek tyrannos,
right,
which the word tyrant comes from, but in what we're talking about means a king, a ruler.
And you can see this in the translation of the famous play by Sophocles, Oedipus Tyrannos, typically translated Oedipus the King.
That's right.
So there on the coast of Ionia, there's a little town named Miletus, and the tyrant of that town was a man named Aristagoras.
And he rises up against the Persians.
Yes. He instigates a revolt of the whole Ionian coast. So all up and down, he tries to galvanize support against the westward moving Persian Empire.
This is the flashpoint.
That's
the,
right.
This is the Franz Ferdinand moment.
You're right.
Yeah.
You could call this the first Greco-Persian War. If we want to divide it up into three groups, it's kind of convenient that way. So about 499 to 495.
Yes.
Then the second one we'll just mention in a moment is 490 in the events of Marathon. Skip ahead 10 more years, we're at Thermopylae, 480.
Yeah, so this, the period we're talking about right now is sometimes referred to as the Ionian Revolt.
Correct.
Right? Yeah, first stage.
So what happens then when Aristagoras tries to throw off the local Persian satrap? See, now this is thousands of miles, or at least 1,000 miles, more or less, from Babylon. And apparently, the king, Darius, hadn't even heard the names of many of these places, which were now telling him were no longer going to be under your thumb.
And how did this go over with the king?
It didn't go over well. It didn't go over well, but the conflict was very far from the main source of his power. I think this is just the nature of trying to maintain a distant set of cities in a kingdom of this sort.
Right. I don't want to keep talking about Alexander, but it's in some ways the same problem that Alexander and his successors run into. As soon as Alexander dies, the whole thing kind of starts to break apart.
Correct.
So how do you control this? I mean, the Romans had the same problem. How do you organize and how do you control these far-flung lands?
So Aristagoras leads this revolt, and then, of course, they appeal for help to the Greek city-states on the west side of the Aegean.
Right. Now, I think it's important for our audience to recognize, at least I run into this with my students, there's when they, if they know something about this story, it's thought of in terms of, again, Persian versus Greek, some kind of good guy versus bad guy.
East versus west.
Yes. And I think there's elements of that, but there's also this idea that the Greeks are unified. And they're not at all. I mean, one of the major hurdles that the Greeks have to overcome is that there were a lot of Greeks and Greek city-states that thought, let's throw our lot in with the Persians.
Right.
Just for mere survival.
Yes, this notion of a united Greek front against the Persians is very, very late. And in fact, it doesn't really come to maturity until the Athenian orator Demosthenes in the middle to late 4th century, so 150 years after this event.
Yeah. And any kind of Greek unity we talk about in this conflict is fragile at best.
Yeah, very, very partial.
Yes.
And so those are some of the themes we'll talk about as we get into this. And so the Ionian Greeks appeal to those whom they consider their children, right, who they had sent out as colonies, the Athenians, the Spartans, groups like that. Two city-states responded, Athens and Sparta. And they sent a small navy east across the Aegean. They landed there on the coast. They near Ephesus, they marched to the town of Sardis, which was a Lydian city, but it was a Persian outpost, and they burned the city to the ground.
Yes, and Darius is not happy about this.
No, he gets the telegram, Sardis, stop. Burning, stop. You know, well, it was thousands of miles away.
Right, exactly right.
Thousands of miles? Well, I may be exaggerating, but do the map work, send us some corrections. So, Jeff, where are we headed next?
Well, we're going to talk about the Persian Wars come in basically two waves, and the Battle of Thermopylae happens near the end of the second wave. But so we're going to take you, the listener, through the first invasion of Greece and talk a little bit about these five major battles.
This was after the Ionian Revolt, right?
Right.
The first stage is done. The rest of it we divide up into two. And what happens leading up to Marathon? That's an important date, right?
Yes, exactly. So the Battle of Marathon, I mean, all of these battles that we'll mention, you know, deserve an episode or more of their own. So Darius, he wants revenge. And he wants revenge particularly on the Athenians. He wants also revenge on the Eritreans, city-state on the island of Euboea, off the east coast of the Greek mainland. And his first attempt, he takes his fleet up north, kind of hugging the coastline.
So what was to back up for a second,
yeah,
he wanted revenge for what exactly? Well, let's make sure the listeners are clear on
this. Well, you mentioned the burning of Sardis.
So this is a distant outpost,
yes,
right, in the Persian Empire, a great distance, whatever, from Babylon, and he's upset that the city has been burned?
He's upset that the city's been burned. He's upset up with these upstart, who do they think they are, Greeks? And he's out to, well, I mean, there's a lot of narrative we don't know, but he seems to be, it's an excuse for him to teach them a lesson, mm-hmm, but also to expand the empire. Some historians think that, you know, that Darius had his eyes on solidifying more control in what we would call Thrace and Macedon, in mm-hmm, the northern part of the
north,
the Greek mainland. And this was just part of it.
And this was a fabulously wealthy king, right? The great king, a lot of whose monuments and such can be found in the British Museum. But he had these massive gold coins minted, right, called derricks? Or do I have a different Darius in mind here?
I'm not sure about this.
No?
These large gold coins?
Yeah, with his image on it, called a derrick after
with his,
Darius.
With his wonderful beardy facial hair.
You got a problem with that, Winkle? Yeah, so Darius mints these fabulous gold coins. He is very wealthy. Nobody's going to mess even with the fringes of this expanding massive empire.
Right. One of the problems that Darius and Xerxes run into is the supply chains for these armies that he sends out. It just boggles the mind on how you would even accomplish that.
Yeah, the logistics aren't amazing.
I don't even want to try to guess what's the mileage between Babylon and...
Seems to be a recurring...
The Ionian coast.
Achilles heel of this episode.
But thousands of miles.
It's a long way.
It's a long ways, right? So
I wouldn't want to walk it.
But he's got the money. He's got the manpower.
And the ambition.
And the ambition.
Yeah.
And he's going to go for it.
Yes. So Herodotus records for us that Darius had a servant remind him, I think, two or three times per day, "Master, remember the Athenians.
Oh, right.
Remember the Spartans. Get your revenge." Now, this could be one of those mythologized, fascinating, fabricated episodes on Herodotus's part, but it sure captures the spirit of the occasion.
It reminds me of the Roman thing where the emperor conducting his triumph has the guy next to him saying, "Remember that you are a mortal."
Right, right? He's pulled through the streets in a chariot.
A lot of kind of little whisperings into the leader's ear going on.
Absolutely.
Across the centuries. Yeah.
So Darius is going to invade Greece. This is 490. Most of these battles, all of them in fact, take place in late summer, early fall. Is there a reason for that?
There's fighting season.
Okay.
Yeah.
And specifically moving troops on board ship.
Right, right. So there's a
naval support.
Yes, there's fighting season and there's sailing season. And the Aegean, then as now, is a notoriously difficult sea to sail. And as we'll talk about later, both the Persians and the Athenians and the Greeks run into trouble with storms.
Yes. Now, the Persians had Phoenician support, a point that Peter Green makes very clear.
Mm-hmm.
The Persians had the support of these Phoenician mercenaries. So these would be people from the Levant region, Cyprus, over toward the Orontes River in the east. And of course, their kingdom extended west all along the northern coast of Africa to a place called Carthage. And these Phoenicians were famous for their seamanship, and they were hired by Darius, like many hundreds of thousands of mercenaries, to bring the combined Persian force against Greece.
Right, so he's got the best of the best.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking about that anecdote about the remember the Athenians. Doesn't that takes place after the Battle of Marathon, though?
Ah, yeah, that's right, Jeff. That's right. I was mistaken. So it's after the defeat at Marathon that Darius enlists that servant to tell him. And then that was revenge that Darius never got to take because he died.
He dies, right.
And left it to his son. So what happened at Marathon, real quick?
Right, so just to back up a little bit. So Darius ultimately takes his fleet. He has some trouble in the north, these storms that we were just talking about. And then he decides in a second attempt to go straight across the Aegean. And so he starts island hopping. He famously takes the island of Naxos and a number of these hundreds of islands that circle the Aegean. And ultimately, he lands his fleet at the flat, broad plain at Marathon.
Yes, this is approximately 26.1 miles from Athens itself.
Exactly right. So, and I mean, we'll talk about this in another episode, but
a place we got to visit, if I can just interrupt.
We did.
It was 2011. We took the bus out to Marathon.
We did. It's a great memory.
Oh, it was incredible.
And I wish we had more time to explore there.
Further episode, future episode.
Future episode.
So the Athenians beat up the Persians pretty badly there, right?
They do. And it's one of these great underdog stories. The Persians are landing their boats on the shore. They're offloading their army. They're offloading their cavalry. And the Greeks have to decide, what do we do? Do we wait to kind of let them make the first move, or do we rush them?
Yeah, so in full armor.
Yes.
Before breakfast, they sprint a mile.
Yes.
I'm stealing your thunder here.
No,
this
no,
is
it's just a great story, right?
And they fall upon the Persians while they are debouching from their boats in this naval assault, and they destroy them. They rout them.
They rout them.
Led by a man named
Miltiades.
Miltiades.
Whose helmet you can see in the museum at Olympia.
And that's right. However, as all historians, including Peter Green, like to point out, the near-term success of this led to some long-term problems, which was Athenian politics is now riven between those who think any assembly of Athenian hoplites can beat the Persians, because after all, Miltiades did it. So these are the arch-conservative landholders, and those represented by Themistocles, who will say, that was a one-off. We need to build a navy if we're ever going to defeat the Persians, because they're coming back.
Right, right.
And they're coming back in large numbers.
Yes, right. So that day it worked. This military tactic of having kind of a thin middle line and kind of fatter flanks on the edges. They encircle the Persians in this kind of Venus flytrap maneuver.
Yep, the center gives way and then you fall on them on the side, on the flank.
Yeah, and as Herodotus records it, the Persians didn't know what to do.
Right. So superior technology, superior training, superior motivation, apparently, won the day at Marathon. But it sets up another decade of, as I mentioned, indecision and uncertainty in the heart of Athenian politics.
Right. So for Darius, that's enough. He backs off, he retreats, goes back home, apparently plots another attempt later. He's not going to give up. He's apparently distracted by a rebellion in Egypt and never follows through on his revenge, and he dies.
In 486.
486.
4 years later.
Yep. And so his son Xerxes then takes over, and he's going to finish what his father started.
And that brings us to the twin battles, the naval battle of Artemisium, happening the same time as our topic, Thermopylae.
That's right.
August, September, 480. Mm-hmm. The Greeks go on to win. Everybody knows the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the wars more or less end with the famous naval victory at Salamis and in September 480 and the land battle at Plataea of August of the following year.
Right. So at that point, the War of Independence is won, really.
Mm-hmm.
Persian money is circulating. There's low-level conflict, but the Greeks have their freedom.
Right. And as Peter Green writes, he says it was Artemisium, not Salamis, which the poet Pindar had in mind when he spoke of that, quote, that great fight where the brave sons of Athens planted the shining cornerstone of their freedom.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So we've laid the groundwork for the general background of the history, bringing us down to Thermopylae. And after the break, after we hear from our sponsors, we're going to talk about elements of Spartan society and government that produced a man like Leonidas.
That's right. Let's do it. Today's episode is brought to you by the Portland Brewmasters Ratio Coffee. Ratio has been building premium pour-over machines for several years now. Dave, what do you like about the Ratio?
Oh, Jeff, I love the aesthetics, the morning routine, the flavor. It's a beautiful machine and consistently produces fantastic coffee. When that superheated water courses through its metallic veins at 200 degrees Fahrenheit, I know the cerebral defogging is about to begin. This is one reliable appliance.
Well, how are things looking for Ratio Coffee in the new year?
Well, I understand from founder and classics enthusiast, Mr. Mark Helweg, that Ratio products are now available in Europe. The link is eu.ratiocoffee.com. Ad nauseum listeners get a 15% exclusive discount on the Ratio 6. Now, this amazing machine is all stainless steel and engineered to truly exacting specifications. Jeff, do you want to throw away good money?
I do not.
Okay, well, don't throw it away on some of those lesser products that come in plastic that's no better than the box they're shipped in.
Agreed. Our listeners should go to ratiocoffee.com and enter the special code ANCO, right?
Yes, between now and March 20, 2021, go to ratiocoffee.com and enter special code ANCO for 15% off the Ratio 6. Now, Jeff, this episode of Ad Nauseam is also brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Since 1972, Hackett has been an independent publisher of high-quality translations in the field of classics and many other corners of the humanities. They have offices in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah, Dave, Hackett's growing classics list includes hundreds of titles covering ancient history, literature, philosophy, political science, and classical language study. Hackett editions are ideal both for classroom use and general readership, offering affordable modern translations and editions of classic works with helpful scholarly notes, annotations, and introductions. Dave, what are some of Hackett's specific offerings?
Well, Jeff, their classical lit category includes translations by Lombardo of the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, Ovid's Metamorphoses, and works by Hesiod, Statius, Horace, Sappho, and the list goes on. Hackett also has translations and editions of ancient Greek drama, Aeschylus, Aristophanes, Euripides, Sophocles, the whole gambit, and the Anthology of Classical Myth, which is now in its second edition. Do they cover ancient history, Jeff?
Do they? Hackett has titles on both ancient Greece and Rome, as well as translations of Herodotus, Suetonius, Livy, Thucydides, and more.
That's a mouthful.
It is.
Did you just ask me what I especially love?
No, I didn't, but what do you love?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. I especially love the Hans Orberg series, the Lingua Latina per se illustrata.
All right, so listen up, you little pukes.
Winko, come on.
What?
Don't insult the audience.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We don't have a name for our audience yet, do we?
The Vomitorians?
Vomitorians?
Knights?
I don't think that's going to play in Peoria.
We'll workshop it.
All right.
Ad Nauseam listeners can save 20% on any order and receive free shipping from Hackett Publishing. All you have to do is go to hackettpublishing.com, find the text you want, and enter AN2021 in the box which asks for the coupon code.
That's a great deal. Don't hesitate. Check out hackettpublishing.com today.
So Dave, how's the Moss method going?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah.
The Black Friday Monday, remember that?
I do remember
The Black Friday Cyber Monday promotional we did way back in November. Turned out to be really successful. We got a number of students enrolled. They're now happily learning Greek. The wheels are turning. They're ready to go from neophyte to erudite.
Excellent. And what do your students have to say about it?
Well, they say all kinds of great things, including my friend Jay Curry. He says, quote, "I highly recommend the Moss method, whether you have had no Greek whatsoever, or if you have taken Greek and need a refresher. The Moss Reader, along with Dr. Noe's instructional materials and his videos on each lesson, are top-notch. For the level and quality of instruction, if Dr. Noe were to charge twice the price, something I've thought about, the Moss method would still be a tremendous bargain."
Wow, that is high praise. That's
excellent. Very grateful for it. I didn't even have to pay for that kind of publicity.
That's great. So if students are interested, what can they do?
They need to go to mossmethod.com, or they can always send me an email, and I can walk them through it. Of course, we list the email each time at dave@adnauseum.com. All right, Jeff, so we're on the road to Thermopylae now.
Right.
What was it about Spartan leadership that made them the individuals who showed up at Thermopylae?
Well, I mean, the Spartans are rightly famous for their military prowess. I mean, there's a lot that we simply don't understand about ancient Sparta. It really is, when it comes to kind of concrete historical knowledge, a black box. The Spartans themselves left really almost nothing behind in terms of archaeological remains, in terms of writing. But, I mean, the sources that we do have speak to this amazing ability that their military had just to overrun their enemies. Their organization, their discipline was like no other.
Yes, and in fact, many of the reports that we have of the Spartans, these are historical accounts written by sympathetic Athenians.
Right.
The Spartans themselves, with very few exceptions, were not given to literature. They weren't given to monumental architecture. We have this great quote, in fact, from Thucydides. This is from Book 1 of his history. He says, "Their city," meaning the Spartans, "is not built continuously and has no splendid temples or other edifices. It rather resembles a group of villages, like the ancient towns of Hellas, and would therefore make a poor show."
Right. I think he also says something along the lines of, if one were to go there in future years and walk amongst the ruins, they would say, "This was the great Sparta."
Yeah, they'd never believe it.
They'd never believe it.
In fact, that's something that we have done.
Yeah.
We visited Sparta and we found there, as all visitors do, mostly Roman ruins.
Right.
Yeah, Spartans did not invest in monumental architecture. They did not invest in literature.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I was thinking about the last time I was there was with you.
Yeah, 2011.
2011. And I remember we had some male students along who were kind of gung-ho about the film 300.
Right.
And so they were really...
Is this madness?
This is Sparta.
Sparta.
That sounds like Sean Connery.
Well, that's because Gerard Butler, of course, is Scottish, right?
Scottish, right,
like,
yeah.
The now late Sean Connery.
Right. Then there's a whole thing that we need to cover someday about like the Scottish accent associated with the Spartans and with, and of course William Wallace being a Scot, kind of that,
of course,
the wildness of the Scots. But that's a topic for another day. But I remember when we went there, we had these guys that were kind of gung-ho about that film,
right?
And they were very keen to see Sparta.
Curious.
And you walk up to the site. There's a big statue of Leonidas there by the soccer field.
Yeah, downtown. It's a modern sculpture.
Right. Yeah. And then you start walking up the kind of the hills into the remains of the ancient city. And there's not a lot to see.
No.
Like you said, most of what's there is Roman, and almost nothing that dates back to 5th century.
Where then, Jeff, did the Spartans invest all of their time and energy?
They were a militaristic society. The male children were raised to be warriors. They were shuttled off into barracks at a fairly early age, and they grew up and they were raised with their tent mates.
Of course, one of the factors that historians often cite as to why the society was so militaristic was because it had to keep a large slave population called the Helots. They had to keep them subordinated and under their thumb.
Right. The Helots that did all the work,
right,
kind of fed the population, right? If all of your men are devoted simply to training and preparing for war, you've got to have somebody else doing the construction, doing the agriculture, all of that stuff.
A totally agricultural society, almost no commerce. There was no international shipping, nothing like that. They did have a port, Githium, down on the coast. But Sparta, unlike Athens, unlike Corinth, landlocked.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of the Peloponnese.
Right.
Surrounded by mountains.
Yes.
Try to say something else. Exactly.
Well, it reminds me later on, you know, where the Greeks are trying to unite, to decide who's going to lead what. The Spartan commander is placed in charge of the navy. And the sticks and the craws of a guy like Themistocles and the Athenians. What does Spartan know about leading a navy, right?
Yeah.
It's not a naval power at all. But
27
you're 27
right. miles from the coast, on the river Eurotas.
Yes. It's still, even though the modern city of Sparta is still fairly isolated. It takes a long time to get down there. It's down in the southern part of the Peloponnese.
Not a tourist stop. Most people don't check in there.
Exactly right. Yeah. And for, you know, so unless you're really, you know, geeked about ancient Greek history, it's not a very impressive sight. So
it's got a good little museum.
Nice little museum. It's a beautiful spot, but there's not. If you're expecting the Parthenon, you're not going to find it.
So they keep this large slave population, the Messenians and the inhabitants of Laconia. They keep them under control, and then you have an elite corps, Spartiates, of soldiers who really run the show.
Right. So in terms of leading the army, it's natural that the leadership would fall to them.
Right. Each newborn male in Spartan society is allotted a kleros, a portion of Messenian land, and a family of helots who work that property for him. So it's kind of like a feudal system. A percentage of the produce is given to the Spartan owner annually, and then a little bit is left over for the maintenance of the slave population.
Yeah. So while there was a lot of shared culture, you would say, between the Spartans and other Greek city-states, you know, they spoke dialects of the same language, they worshipped the same gods. Sparta is, in most regards, very unique.
Yes. And this is one of the great ironies that both ancient and modern historians like to point out. The bravery and the heroism of men like Leonidas at Thermopylae, this cornerstone of freedom, was largely based on the shoulders of the slavery of this underclass.
Right.
So for whom were they fighting? Whom were they seeking to keep free?
Exactly. A very good point. And the Spartans would even wage a kind of annual war on their slave population to keep them under their thumb. So the helots were not only doing all the work, but they were also the victims of that Spartan militarism.
Yeah, and how did the Spartans treat those within their society who didn't conform to the militaristic pattern?
Not well.
Yeah. I'm just tossing you a softball there. So very harshly, right, if you didn't live up to the Spartan ideal. Now, Plutarch famously says of Spartan women that they get to share in the governance of the state because they are the only ones who give birth to Spartan men.
Right. If a child was born with a slight deformity, the story goes they would be abandoned. They would be thrown into a pit. And it's that kind of what we might call kind of your racial purity that ultimately does them in. It's within just a few generations of Leonidas that the Spartans are more or less gone.
Yeah, they are overwhelmed by the Thebans, right? Mm-hmm. The famous soldiers of Epaminondas, one of the mentors and teachers of Philip II. And by Roman times, they're just a name.
Right.
The Spartans are just a name, nothing
right.
more.
Exactly. The ancients and modern historians will talk about the Spartan mirage. And so they survive as this wonderful myth. But you're right, they're overwhelmed by other powers, and they kind of, their adherence to this kind of birth purity, they just dwindle in numbers.
Yeah, the most famous Roman gladiator, a man named...
I don't know his name.
Spartacus.
Oh, of course, right.
What's his name? Kirk Douglas?
Kirk Douglas, yes.
Yeah. All right, let's try that again. The most...
Yeah, rewind that.
The most famous Roman gladiator.
Spartacus.
You're not on much sleep today, are you?
I'm not, sorry.
That's okay. I know, you were up late last night. Spartacus was actually a Thracian.
That's right.
Not Spartan at all.
No, the Wild North.
Right, but given that moniker, that name, because it represents ferocity.
Right, and it still shows up as an athletic mascot, the Michigan State Spartans.
And there are all these early legends of the unusual marriage relationships and domestic arrangements within Spartan society.
Right, very incestuous.
Yes, there's the famous, you know, elements of homosexuality, which mm-hmm. scholars are quite divided on precisely what it means. There's one interesting legend that in early days, spouses were assigned at random. This is called endogamy, you know, marriage within the group. Hmm. The notion being that one spouse is as good as the next. If we're all Spartans, it doesn't really matter whom you marry.
Incredible. Incredible.
Yeah. Women didn't have to do any domestic tasks.
This that was still all, the slave population taking
that's
care
right.
of it. They
it
were there to,
all of that.
To produce male children.
Yep. Yeah. The education was paid for by the state. Older men and women served as mentors to the younger ones. All of this was dedicated and designed, really, in an almost communistic fashion, mm-hmm. which is what fascinated the Athenians, to producing great warriors.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about how Spartan government worked, what we know about that, because this is relevant to the person of Leonidas and kind of how he became king and how he became the leader of this expedition.
Yeah, so in a way that's similar to the Romans, they had a dual kingship. The Romans have consuls, right? Two consuls with veto power. Mm-hmm. The Spartans had two kings, equal in authority, checked each other. Imagine how conservative this would make them. Nothing gets done unless both kings agree. One is in charge of the military, so entirely outward facing. The other is in charge of domestic affairs.
And so it's kind of a combination of, if we look at the other elements, it's a combination between a kind of proto-democracy, mm-hmm. clear kind of oligarchic elements as well.
Yeah, it's presented as an ideal example of the mixed constitution in Aristotelian terms. You have a monarchy, you have the oligarchy, which is represented by the gerousia, the council mm-hmm. of elders. It's a word that means old man. They had judicial functions, approved bills for assembly. They could veto assembly decisions. And then you had a more democratic element, like you were saying, which was the assembly itself.
Right. So they would hear proposals, they would vote to reject or accept proposals. They met once a month. They elected other officials within the government.
Yeah, but what was really interesting about this assembly? There's this one crucial fact about the Spartan assembly that separates it from the other kinds, and that is that it was not deliberative.
What would they do? And just kind of
no debate.
Just shouting.
No, they just met to make decisions.
So they didn't talk about them. They didn't throw it back and forth. They just.
I assume most of the debating and discussion took place before they entered the Boulaterion, the assembly hall. And then there's no debate on the propositions. The propositions are brought to the assembly. They just vote up or down. That's it.
They didn't want to hang around. They want to get in and out.
No.
Yeah.
This was for law enforcement and education. Those were their responsibilities.
And then there were also the E4s.
The E4s.
What do they do?
I don't know.
No.
Why don't you explain for our audience? What's an E4 anyway?
What are the E4s? The E4s were for supervising the kings. They presided over the gerousia and the assembly. They also had supervising powers over education, in charge of the famous crypteia.
Yeah, look at the hidden secret thing.
The secret thing, where
a quasi-religious function, you might say.
And it was also kind of a rite of passage for young Spartan men to, at least part of it was going out and proving their mettle by killing a helot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
a helot is a human being,
yes.
Right? One of these individuals that is enslaved to the elite Spartiates.
Exactly, and another way of kind of keeping them under control.
Yes, and so these E4s had to spy on and in fact kill the helots that were prone to rebel.
Incredible. Yeah, I would not have liked to have been a helot.
No, I don't think I could have survived in Spartan society.
No, exactly.
Whatsoever. And while, I mean, we're getting here a little bit into interpretation as we start the downslope to the end of the episode, but while either there's much I admire about Leonidas and his gallantry, in fact, we have this great quote from Peter Green that we'll get to it, but it is to Leonidas's eternal credit that he decided to stay at Thermopylae. Below, beneath, supporting him is a lot of really nasty stuff.
Indeed. There's lots of debate. As we mentioned earlier in the episode, the Greeks were very divided. They all had their turf. They all had their, even within cities, there were factions that wanted to simply Medes, go over to the Persians. They were saying, no, we need to protect our own city. So there were all these turf wars. And one of the big debates was, okay, we have to get together. We have to unite in some regard. And when we do that, where can we stop or where can we delay the Persians the best? And so it came down to geography. And so the northern Greeks, the Thessalian Greeks were saying, let's do the stand at the Gorge of Tempe, which is near Mount Olympus. Again, kind of a narrowing choke point. And they were, of course, the northern Greeks were hoping that the rest of Greece would play along because they protect their own territory.
They're the most exposed.
They'd
be the first ones to bear the assault of all of these, as many as maybe 2 million, Herodotus says.
Yeah.
Persian forces, as led by Xerxes and company. That number's probably exaggerated, but a huge amount of persons coming from the east to pour down into Greece.
Right. I mean, whatever the numbers were, it was a massively lopsided, right? And the Peloponnesians, on the other hand, they said, we got this isthmus, this narrow band of land that joins, you know, mainland Greece to the Peloponnesus.
Right. When you drive west from Athens, you go across the isthmus past Corinth to get down into the Peloponnese.
Right.
It's a natural defense.
It is. It's very narrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's driving through it, like you mentioned, there's not much land on either side of that road.
No, you can see the sea on both sides at points.
Yeah.
And of course, what they do then is they do, in fact, build a wall of defense there.
Mm-hmm.
The Peloponnesians do, but it's really not going to be effective because, as mentioned before, the Persians have a great navy under mostly Phoenician leadership.
Right.
So they're fighting, like you say, and some Greek city-states, I think that historians say as many as a third, have already Medized. And in fact, there's a Greek verb, I really think this is fascinating, called Medidzo.
What does that mean?
It means to act like a Mede. And of course, it was the Medo-Persian Empire. So when you say Medidzo, it means to join the Persian army.
Hmm.
Greek has this ability easily to form verbs. You just add the idzo ending. So Medidzo is recorded by Herodotus, by Thucydides, by Xenophon, Demosthenes. It's a pretty rare word, but a lot of Greek city-states said, look, it's foolish. It's absurd to resist such a massive force. Why don't we just take the bribe?
Exactly.
Xerxes is wealthy. He's going to give us other people's land. Let's be a part of the Persian Empire.
So a third of Greeks, an incredible hurdle anyway to be the underdog in this fight, but to have that much of the population basically saying, not interested.
Right. And especially the Thebans, right? This northern city-state. This is a point that Peter Green makes. The Spartans wanted to see what were the Thebans going to do.
Right.
I think they were the second or third largest after Athens, Sparta, Corinth. Thebes was enormous.
What right, enormous, and also renowned for their military prowess.
Yes, and Green strategically
talks
located.
Right. Green talks a lot about Herodotus has this kind of anti-Theban bias.
Yeah, well, don't we all?
Well, exactly.
I have no time for Thebans.
No time for Thebans. But he talks about we need to be, you know, kind of careful with that. But the Thebans were apparently renowned for their Medizing tendencies.
Well, there's a lot of money at stake. These giant gold coins that Xerxes' father Darius had minted.
Fit in the vending machines in Greece, though. But
not going to work for a bottle of chilled ouzo.
That's
right?
That's exactly
on a summer
right.
afternoon.
Right. So to get back to kind of these strategic points, like you said, the isthmus wasn't going to work because of the Persians' naval power. It turned out that the Gorge of Tempe up in the north wouldn't work because there were too many ways around it.
And there wasn't adequate time
right.
to fortify it.
Exactly right. So it's a long way for the Spartan army to march. I mean, it was long enough to Thermopylae. Here you're talking, again, I'm not going to even guess miles, but many
time.
More time yeah. to get up there. And so they settle upon the choke point at Thermopylae in
it
central
seemed,
Greece.
It seems yeah. that they could march 60 to 70 miles per day.
Is that right?
Which is phenomenal because it's over rough terrain, right?
That's, full armor?
Yeah, that's yeah. 10 to 12 hours of marching at a fast pace.
Incredible.
This was the amazing discipline that the Spartans were famous for. So Leonidas is the king. He's dispatched by the Spartan government in cooperation, coordination with the other city-states like Athens to try to make a northern defense.
Yes. And he sent it as it's an advance guard, right? I think one of the myths about Thermopylae is that Leonidas went there just with the 300 and made this heroic stand there with just the 300, but there's so much more to it.
Yeah, there were probably as many as 7,000 at the beginning of the conflict.
Exactly. And we'll get more into those numbers of who those were next time in our next episode. But Leonidas couldn't go with a full army because of this festival that was going on. It was the same problem that happened with the Battle of Marathon. The Spartans didn't end up sending troops there because they were bound by these rituals that prevented them from engaging in military exploits back home. And so the Carneia, we don't fully kind of know what it was. It was a festival in honor of Apollo. It was like we think a lot of rituals at Sparta. It was an expiation rite, probably originated some kind of bloodletting ritual. It had agricultural, it had military, it had expiation.
This is all off
it.
The top of your head. So you've put some time into this.
I remember reading about this a while back.
Yeah, this is not in the show notes.
So it seems to be kind of a mishmash of different things. It involved a quasi-legend, this guy named Carnus, who was a spy that was murdered by the Spartans or the Dorians.
But they couldn't break this festival,
They couldn't
right?
break this festival, right. This figure of Carnus was sacred to Apollo. And so he demanded kind of this expiation right on part of the Spartans annually.
But Leonidas and the 300 who depart, this is technically breaking sacred Spartan law.
Right. And it's hard to overstate how serious that is.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's because there's an existential threat to Spartan life, and that is the Persians as they approach.
Right. And to add to that, the Olympic Games were also going on, which also had this kind of these brackets around it that you didn't fight. You didn't take up arms during the period kind of before, during, and after the Olympic Games. So there were all of these kind of ritual and cultural elements that were also working against the Greeks at this time.
But they're headed off. They're going to do what they can.
Yes.
And together with the other Greek city-states, they draw a line from Thermopylae to the east, to the Aegean, and the very famous naval battle of Artemisium. Topics
right.
We'll cover next time.
Yes.
So in addition to the 7,000 Greeks, probably as many as 150,000 Persian allied forces choked into this narrow pass.
That's what I take to be kind of the most common estimate. So like you said, Herodotus talks about almost 2 million.
The total entourage.
Right, which a lot of historians think demographically wasn't even possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a massively lopsided fight.
Yeah, ancient numbers aren't the same as the way we use numbers today.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. And 10,000 immortals. Right, the elite corps, and we'll get into that next time as well.
So as we wrap this up, Dave, you have a quote from Peter Green about this exact spot, right?
Yes, I do. This is from pages 113 and 114. He says, "Owing to the silting up of the Malian Gulf, the coastline today has retreated several miles from the hot gates." That's what the word Thermopylae means, right? Which the locals here, this is not Peter Green, this is my editorializing, the locals called it Pulai, right, from Thermopylae. Just like people here in Grand Rapids, you know, natives, we refer to it as PIDs, right?
Exactly, yeah. Are you from the PIDs?
I'm from PIDs, right? Just like the locals said, Pulai, the gates.
The gates.
Thermopylae. So back to Peter Green. "It has retreated several miles from the hot gates, making it hard for a visitor to visualize the pass as Leonidas found it in 480 BC. Where the Spartans set up their defenses, it was less than 20 yards wide. And at two other points, east and west of Thermopylae, near Anthela and Alpeni respectively, it narrowed still further to the breadth of a single wagon track."
So just 20 yards?
Yeah, 20 yards. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's like an entire rushing season for the Detroit Lions.
That's about right. In a good year.
In a good year. All right, Jeff, so we got to wrap things up. In this episode, we have looked at the beginnings of the conflict. We talked about the Ionian Revolt and so forth, the main characters and players. We looked at Spartan government, right?
Yes, we did. And we got our man to the site. We got Leonidas and his kind of fragile band of allies at the site of Thermopylae.
So we're ready to go for the conflict.
We're ready to go. I can feel the tension.
Episode 20. It's building, isn't it?
It is.
You think you're going to be able to wait a week before we bring this home to roost?
It's going to be hard.
Bring it home to roost? It's a day of mixed metaphors, isn't it?
It is, yes.
All right, so let's wrap it up. Listeners, we are so grateful that you have been tuning in. We're rapidly approaching 5,000 downloads.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah,
very gratified by that. If you'd like to leave us some feedback, especially trenchant criticisms, please send them to dave@adnauseum.com. Praise can go to
jeff@adnauseum.com.
Don't forget the V in there.
That's right.
Check out our website. We got show notes there. Next week, as we've been saying all along, maybe too much, Thermopylae and History Part 2.
Yeah, we're going to go through all 3 days of the battle. It's going to be great. And Dave, I believe you have our gustatory parting shot today.
I do, but first we want to give a note of gratitude.
Of course.
To our amazing audio engineer, Miss Mishka Fernando. Thank you so much.
She's the best.
For the things she puts together for us. And I do get the gastroclassical Fare Thee Well, don't I?
Let's hear it.
All right. This is from Ambrose Bierce, American writer, covered the Civil War. I like this. He says, "Mayonnaise, one of the sauces which serve the French in place of a state religion."
That's great. See you next time.